this week's Yes to Life show. Regular listeners will know that on the Yes to Life show, I host a wide range of interesting and inspirational guests from the world of integrative medicine for cancer. This week is no exception. I'm talking to a highly experienced nutritionist who has supported very many people with cancer, Kirsten Chick. The subject is the gut microbiome, a topic that's gained increasing attention in recent years, and for good reasons it seems. I'm speaking to Kirsten over Skype at her home in Sussex. Hi Kirsten, great to have you back on the show. I think it's been more than a year since I last spoke to you.
Hi Robin, has it been that long? Wow.
It has, yes. So the subject for today's discussion is the microbiome. So up until a couple of years ago, the man in the street, chaps like me, had never even heard of the microbiome, but now it's kind of common currency in health sections of newspapers and magazines. Gut flora and the microbiome is one of the most hotly discussed topics in a whole range of areas of medicine, and cancer is no exception. So what's behind its sudden move to centre stage?
Well, there has been an explosion of research over the past kind of 8 to 10 years, really, and it's all been really exciting. Gut bacteria has been looked at in novel ways that haven't really been explored before. There's a lot of links between gut bacteria and inflammation and the immune system, which we've always known a bit about, but scientists have done a lot more research into. And also lots of exciting stuff around the gut wall and the gut bacteria and microbiota in the gut, so all the different organisms in the gut, and how that influences the brain, mood, behaviour, stress pathways, and so on. So it's hot topics in all kinds of realms, such as addiction, as well as physical health, and so on. So, yeah, it's really exciting.
Okay, well, we're going to get down to the nitty-gritty a bit as we go through the show, I hope. So I believe that we're now estimated to be made up of more bacteria than we got cells, begging the question whether we're really just a moving pile of bugs. Anyway, it does place bacteria in a very different light to the way they were viewed really only a few years ago as a kind of menace to be eradicated with strong chemicals. So how reliant are we really on them, and you know, where would we be without our bugs?
Well, we've evolved with them, really. We wouldn't be anywhere without bugs. We have always had them as part of our makeup since we were tiny clusters of cells evolving eventually into human beings. So I can't imagine what we would be like without them. And it's not just bacteria, it's kind of fungi and viruses and all sorts of things that we normally think of as bad, negative things. And what we really have to start thinking is that each of us is like a mini planet with our own jungles and seascapes that are filled with living beings that are part of our own ecosystem. So it's not as easy as saying these ones are bad, these ones are good, although we can categorize them a little bit like that. But our ecosystem and its balance has a direct impact on who we are, how we live, how we behave in all kinds of ways. And we're really just at the tip of the iceberg with that. Perhaps we always will be, because it's so there's so much a part of our makeup that I wonder if we'll ever get a handle on everything that they do for us and everything that we do for them. But we certainly know that they help us to digest foods. They help to produce some further nutrients as well. They're very involved in our inflammation responses and immune system responses. As I was saying, our mood and behaviour as well, our stress responses. There's so much that they do, and they're really at the interface where wherever we have our bodies are somehow exposed to the outside as well. So our skin, any kind of holes, crevices, that whole tunnel that goes from our mouth to our anus, the digestive tract, all of those places, in particular that digestive tract, we have lots of bacteria. So they're very much an interface with our own environment too.
Okay, well, it's clearly we've got a codependent relationship here. Symbiotic is the kind of word that gets applied, I think. And a kind of central advantage that we seem to gain from this relationship is our immune function. So how big a part does our microbiome play in our immune defences?
Well, it's pretty massive, really. So really at that, so as I was saying, that they're there at our interface with the rest of the universe. And one of their jobs is to really filter out what's coming into the body and really help us to determine what's beneficial to us, what's not so beneficial to us. So we have, for example, these areas in our small intestine called Peyer's patches. These aren't made up of microbes, but our microbes, our gut flora, do decide which items to send to the Peyer's patches. And the Peyer's patches are kind of, they're little centres where we examine foreign substances and decide whether they're harmful or not. But it's interesting that we now know that it's our gut bacteria that decides whether to send things to the Peyer's patches for analysis or whether, so they're the first line of defence, having a look to see which foreign body, which things coming into the body might be harmful and which ones might be okay. So there's that aspect. They also will directly trigger other kinds of immune system activity, so inflammation responses or calming down inflammation, different parts of the different kinds of white blood cells that deal with things throughout the body. So they're very much a triggering. I like to think of them as at the hub of our immune system, or one of the hubs of our immune system, really triggering what's going on. They also, of course, self-regulate each other as well. So that's why if you have a lot of probiotics, for example, or fermented foods that contain beneficial gut bacteria, and there's a sudden influx of lots of those, then they will they'll be toxic to other kinds of microbes in the body, and so you'll get a huge die-off, as some people have experienced themselves, in the in those bacteria that are considered to be more toxic. So they're very self-regulating as well. They're dependent on the local environment, so they try and create an environment for themselves that's nice and healthy. But if our internal environment isn't so great, then different kinds of bacteria will proliferate. And some health experts think that one of the roles there is to then try and get the environment back to how it was before, so that we can get back to our original balance of bacteria. So there's a lot we don't completely know or fully understand still about the gut bacteria, but it's really fascinating.
So it sounds like they're acting as a bit of a sort of signalling service for the rest of our immune system to get going. They're not directly part of our immune system, but they're actually sending messages in some way to the immune system to act.
Yeah, exactly that. And also they produce lots of different substances. Different gut bacteria will produce different substances. And some of those will trigger the immune system in different ways. So, for example, some of them might produce secondary bile acids or short chain fatty acids, which might suppress inflammation, for example, or might trigger inflammation. So they're actually producing different substances that have different effects as well. So it's not just the balance of bacteria, it's when they eat it, or when they help us digest food, they produce metabolites that then affect our immune system as well.
Extraordinary relationship, really, isn't it? It's so complex, and obviously mutually beneficial.
Yeah, and there's just so many of them. You've mentioned we've got more bacteria cells than human cells, and not, you know, if you add the whole microbiome with the archaea and the viruses and the fungi and all of that together, it's even more. Fortunately, they're much smaller than human cells, so we can still say we're more human than bacteria.
Okay.
But if you do a number count, there are more bacterial cells. I think, 10 times more bacterial cells off the top of my head or maybe it's much more than that, than human cells. So there's a lot of them. But actually what's interesting as well is the many different kind of species, the many different kinds of bacteria and other microbes. There's thousands of different families living within us. And actually the more biodiverse, the healthier and stronger we seem to be. So it's a case of how much biodiversity that we're getting there as well. And with so much going on and so many different kinds, it's going to take a lot to figure out exactly what they're doing and how they're doing it. But we can, in the meantime, trust that we have this amazing symbiotic relationship, and we need to be nurturing that.
Mm-hmm. Can I pick up on one word you say? You talked about biodiversity. That's obviously, as you say, something that's good to have as an internal environment there. Similarly, in our external environment, one of the things that's happening is we're moving away from biodiversity. You know, all apples are the same kind of apples in the supermarket. And this is happening, right across the board. I assume there's some relationship between the two. The more we settle for monocultures of one kind or another, we're shortchanging our internal environment.
Yeah, that does seem to be the case. And people that still live in tribal conditions with, in jungles with more biodiversity and also more exposure to bacteria than we have in our more kind of hygienic environments. There's a double-edged sword to that hygienic environment that we live in. And one is that we have less diverse bacteria in our guts and throughout our bodies. And that does have an impact. The food we eat very much impacts the biodiversity of our gut flora. So if we're eating a really well-balanced diet with lots of different kinds of, not just lots of different kinds of foods, but as you say, lots of different kinds of apples, lots of different kinds of carrots, of different, those different aspects that we've lost, it is bound to have an impact. And everything is interrelated in our body. So it's not just the exposure to bacteria that we get from eating different foods, but it's also the different antioxidants that we get, the different levels of proteins, the different qualities of sugars and fats. Those kinds of things all have a fundamental influence on our tissue health, and our tissue health will have a fundamental influence on our gut bacteria, and vice versa. It all affects each other, so it's bound to have an influence. And I think we're very much paying the price for that with these chronic illnesses that we see to be more prevalent today. So by getting a grip with hygiene, or we've managed to resolve a lot of the deaths from infections that used to happen. But we've been left with all of these chronic illnesses being much, much more prevalent. And I think they have probably taken hold because of what we've just been talking about.
So I believe there's a strong connection emerging between the bacteria in the mouth, and that's often thought of something as terrible to be eradicated with, lots of mouthwashes, etc., and the bacteria in the gut. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, and actually there's bacteria throughout the digestive tract. So much of our bacteria is kind of generated in the small intestine. Most of it lives in the large intestine, but we get bacteria throughout the digestive tract, including the mouth, the esophagus, the stomach, all the way through the intestines, the rectum, the anus. And that bacterial balance actually can affect our systemic bacteria. So we have bacteria everywhere in the body. I mentioned the kind of crevices and tunnels and surfaces and skin before. That's where most of the rest of the bacteria is. But bacteria has actually also been found in tissue cells and in tumours themselves, in fact, in tumour tissue and in non-cancerous tissue. And there is an impact. So whatever's going on in that bacterial balance in the gut does seem to impact what's going on with bacteria elsewhere in the body. So with bacteria in the mouth, for example, there's been studies on the bacterial balance with oral cancer, which is much more of an obvious one. Yeah. And indeed, actually, there's certain kinds of bacteria in the mouth that can be used as predictors for oral cancer. So there was one study where they looked at the bacteria in the mouths of people with oral cancer and with control subjects where people didn't have oral cancer, mouth cancer. And 80% of the people with cancer, the cancer was predicted by the presence of these three salivary bacteria. And they also managed to correctly predict that 83% of the control subjects didn't have mouth cancer because they didn't have high levels of these bacteria. Mm. Now, that was, I think that was around 2005, but much more recently, 2011, there's another study that's shown an association between the bacteria and microbes in the mouth and pancreatic cancer as well. Yes. So where there's pancreatic cancer, there are 31 types of bacteria that are higher in the mouth and 25 types that are lower in the mouth with people with pancreatic cancer compared to people without pancreatic cancer. And one of those in particular actually overlaps with the previous piece of research, something called Streptococcus mitis was particularly looked at there. And that same bacteria also is related to people with chronic pancreatitis, but not necessarily pancreatic cancer, but the inflammation aspect there. So there is this association that's been directly looked at between oral or mouth microbes, mouth bacteria, and cancers elsewhere in the body and illnesses elsewhere in the body. And the same's true for example, the gut bacteria. There's years of research into gut bacteria and colon cancer and colorectal cancer, because that's an obvious one to look at. Sure. If you've got bacteria in the gut creating inflammation, does that eventually lead, or can that eventually lead to cancer because of the association between inflammation and cancer? And the research is pretty well established that yes, it can. But actually, there's now more research showing that actually there's a link with cancers elsewhere in the body as well, like liver cancer and breast cancer. So you can look at the bacteria in the gut and see how that's influencing cancer throughout the body. So yes, with microbes in the mouth, with microbes in the gut, they definitely seem to have an effect systemically and not just on the local area.
Mm. So it's felt that that is the case. It's not just that they're a kind of symptom, if you like, of what's going on in the gut. They're actually part of the problem.
Well, that's an age-old thing that it's always really hard to distinguish between whether things are a symptom or causative. Mm. And that's a really good question to throw up. And that's why a lot of scientists have tried to look at the mechanisms by which this might be happening. Mm. So what is it about these microbes that are driving inflammation? And what is it about inflammation that drives cancer? And those pathways have been looked at and identified. Again, we're still at the tip of the iceberg for all of that, but I think there's enough evidence there to really be taking that seriously and really be looking at that. But I think the converse is also true. I think somebody with cancer or with any chronic disease is going to have an environment in their body which is ripe for a bacterial imbalance or a microbial imbalance. Yeah. So if anything, I believe, and I think the evidence points to this as well, that it's more of a vicious cycle than just a one-way street.
Right.
Everything really influences each other in the body. So I think both of those things are true. And I used to think that it was more likely that the conditions were just right for both. I used to think, well, if somebody's got the conditions where a tumour is likely to grow, then the same in the same conditions, there's likely to be a bacterial imbalance and fungal overgrowths and things like that. But actually, there's a lot more evidence now showing that the converse is true as well, that that they actually directly impact each other in many more ways than we thought possible.
Interesting. Now, if we can home in a bit on cancer itself, cancer could be understood as shortcomings in our immune system. This is the result of this. How much do you think damage to our gut flora by modern living, things such as our diet and stress, and our use of chemical cleaners and personal care products, how much could these be contributing to a weak microbiome and therefore to chronic disease?
Yeah, I think all of them can do so quite significantly, actually. It's been well documented that certain medications, for example, can have a negative impact on gut, on the microbiome, not least antibiotics, mm-hmm. which obviously there's been a lot of press over the years as to how over antibioticized we are, if there's such a word, and the effect that that's had. There's also been some interesting research into obesity. Obesity is a huge issue now. I don't think it's just an issue of overeating. I think there's much more to obesity than just overeating. And I think there are stress and inflammation pathways involved with that too. But it's interesting how there's a pathway that's been looked at with, because if you're eating a lot of fat, you're going to be producing a lot more bile acids, because bile helps to break down fat. So then in the gut, you're going to have a lot more bile acids there. And if levels of a certain bacteria called Clostridia are really high, then that creates a substance called DCA, which has been linked to DNA damage. And where there is a real link between obesity and certain kinds of cancer, especially breast, uterine, colon, and kidney cancer, deaths related to cancer are 14% higher in obese men, 20% higher in obese women. And weight loss actually can reduce levels of that bacteria, Clostridia. And then if you're eating less fat, then it's going to reduce the level of bile acids there. So that's going to bring that figure down. And another thing that's interesting about Clostridia is that antibiotic use has been shown to up Clostridia levels as well. So there's, as I said, there's all kinds of influences as to why we have more obesity in modern society. But that's definitely increased rates of cancer. So there'll be a dietary aspect of that and also a stress aspect of that. There's a lot more chemicals in the environment, and a lot of those chemicals are fat soluble for a start. So where there's obesity, there's going to be potentially a bigger problem there. But they're also estrogen mimicking. So if you look at all of the different chemicals in the water, in the food, in things like Teflon and various artificial fabrics and paints and aerosols and lipsticks and all sorts of things we have in our modern environment, a lot of them are estrogen mimicking, and that's certainly going to have an effect. And it's the one of the things the bowel flora does actually is help us to decide whether or not we have too much or too little estrogen in our bodies, and either get rid of it or recycle it. So there's very much a link between those two as well. So particularly for things like breast cancer and uterine cancer, but for a lot of other cancers too. So there's lots of different relationships. And the biggest thing that comes up again and again and again is stress. And we've always had stress in our lives. Right back when we were hunter-gatherers, there were still stresses and traumas around us. But the ways that our bodies respond to stress don't seem to be very healthy these days. We seem to be getting stuck in our stress responses a lot more than we used to. And a lot of people seem to be being born just in shock, in stress, with their stress responses switched on.
Wow.
That impacts a lot of things in the body, and one of the main things that it impacts is how well we're able to reduce inflammation in our bodies. And if we're in long-term stress response, our cortisol receptors throughout our body stop working, so it becomes very difficult to calm down inflammation. And I think that's probably one of the strongest mediators of chronic illness, is that fact that we're in chronic stress, which means that we have chronic inflammation going on that we just can't physically calm down. And one of the drivers for that is a chain of command that we call the HPA axis. And that's basically, H stands for the hypothalamus in the head, which tells the pituitary, also in the head, which tells the adrenals to release our stress hormones. So it's just a little chain of command that releases our stress hormones and keeps us in that stress response. And I've been interested in that HPA axis for a long time and its role in inflammation and health. But what's emerged with a lot of research about gut bacteria is how our gut bacteria influences whether or not that HPA axis is stimulated and switched on. And it's been noted both with gut bacteria that's already there and also taking probiotics that affect our gut bacteria, that can have an effect of producing substances that will stimulate or calm down the HPA axis directly. So there's that direct impact with stress and our gut bacteria. And again, that goes two ways. If we're more stressed, then that will create conditions directly in the gut that can trigger the HPA axis. And as a result, that impacts our gut bacteria. And that can be another little cycle. But there's been various studies where one or two key ones in particular, where probiotic use has been shown to calm down that HPA axis, so calm down the whole stress response, which means that it may help take us to a place where we can calm down inflammation again, and that will really put the brake on the development of chronic illness, as far as I can tell.
Mm. Very interesting.
Sense.
Mm. Well, what you're talking about here, is, in very real terms, is your gut response, yeah?
Yeah, and we've talked about the gut brain and the gut central nervous system axis for a long time now, and we've been well aware that our moods affect our gut. So if we're stressed, we can get more cramps, we can get more the conditions in our gut can change, and so that will affect our gut bacteria balance, but also the health of the lining of our gut. And how our gut is really behaving. It switches off our digestive system. If we're in a stressful situation, the last thing we need to be thinking about is digesting a meal. So that whole function gets downgraded. So our digestive secretions are interrupted. And one effect of that is that our stomach acids are interrupted, and we end up with lower levels of stomach acid. So more toxic microbes can get through to the gut and create problems as well. So we're not killing off as many microbes that are coming into the body. But also, we're not digesting our food properly, which means that we won't get as much nutrition from our food or energy from our food, but also we'll be left with partially digested particles that create more inflammation in our gut that contributes to more gut bacterial imbalance. And we've known about that for a long time, and that where that's going on, so not only will stress impact that, but when there's lots of inflammation in our gut, we know that we don't feel so great. We might feel nervous or stressed or sleepy, or it's been well documented for a very, very long time now. We've known about the nervous connection between the brain and the gut, where there's so many nerve endings in the gut that go up via the vagus nerve, a lot of them, to the brain. And connect the brain and the gut in that way. Actually, we used to think that the vagus nerve was there to for the brain to tell the gut how to behave, but now we know that 80% of the communication is the other way. So 80% of vagus nerve communication between the gut and the brain is the gut telling the brain how to respond to things because of what's going on in the gut. So we've known about this this connection for a long time. What's now become apparent, and I find this really intriguing, is that things like serotonin and dopamine, these are neurotransmitters that we associate, we call them our happy chemicals in our brain. Most of those are actually produced in the gut,
really?
Either gut wall or by the gut bacteria. So that's another influence on how what's going on in the gut can directly impact our mood and behaviour in that day. And that's something that's been a real eye-opener and is starting to affect the world of psychotherapy these days as well.
Mm. Yes, I mean, our feelings of well-being are very much centred around the gut, aren't they? If everything's calm down there, you feel calm, don't you?
Exactly. We've always known this. Our language is built up around this, having a gut feeling, having butterflies, all of those kinds of phrases and visual images that we have around that. So it's something that we've always been really aware of. And science is, as you know, there's so much going on there that it's going to take science a long while to figure out what's going on with that. Mm. It's so complex and so magical that there's a lot to look at, there's a lot to understand. So this kind of, I feel like we're having a bit of a growth spurt in our understanding of the gut microbiome at the moment. That's brilliant. But, 100 years from now, we'll probably look back and think, gosh, we knew so little. And actually that then was just, a tiny drop in the ocean of what the gut is capable of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can we come back now to antibiotics? These are something that most people have encountered, sometimes just occasionally, but some people have had a lot of antibiotics, and there's not really much encouragement to do anything about the fact you're having antibiotics. You've already said, actually, you think this is one of the factors that's playing into a lot of the chronic ill health. Do you want to say a bit more about that?
Yeah, well, it has been really well documented, and doctors and specialists know now that it's a huge problem. And so there's been a public health campaign to try and get people to ask for antibiotics a lot less, understand that actually they shouldn't be turned to all the time, and they certainly shouldn't be used for viruses and things that aren't related to bacterial imbalance. So there's been that whole public health message. And I've seen with my own health, in my own practice, I've been working with people as a nutritionist for, I think it's about 13 or 14 years now. And I've seen time and time and time again how people's immune systems and general health can be battered by prolonged antibiotic use. Antibiotics can be phenomenal in certain situations. They can be really life-saving. They can really take the edge off things. But there's a darker side to antibiotics that we all really need to be made aware of, and that is that they can really mess with the biodiversity and the balance and the general health of that that core of our immune system. I've seen it play out in lots of different ways. One thing that I love working with children, Robin, because I work with people with all kinds of different conditions, and also people that haven't got anything wrong with them and just want to be as in optimal health. But I do work with children a fair amount, and I've had lots of children brought to me over the years with terrible digestive disorders, whether they've been diagnosed or not, and also night terrors or some kind of mental health issue or agitation, and the two often go hand in hand. And where I've just worked on their gut bacteria and the health of the gut, things resolve so quickly. And that's why I love working with children, is because they have generally so much inner vitality that you can, if you if you catch an issue quite early with the child, you can make a difference very quickly. The more chronic things become, whether with children or with adults, but it's more common that things are set in for years with adults, then the harder it can be, the slower it can be to turn a situation around. But when you're working with children with lots of inner vitality, and you can see how things switch around so quickly just by working on that one area, then you know there's got to be something in it. So it's a first-hand thing coupled with all of the research that I've done. I'm just really convinced that that we need to be aware of the mess that we can end up with antibiotic use. Even if they've been life-saving in some way, we have to repair the gut afterwards. Right. And we have to do it as quickly as possible.
Okay, well, we're going to get on talking about strategies for that in just a minute. Mm-hmm. Could we speak a bit now about orthodox cancer treatments? They're legendary for killing off everything in their wake. Chemotherapy and radiotherapy. What's the story with those and your microbiome?
Yes, they do. They do kill it off. There is evidence around that. So especially with certain types of chemotherapy, generally all radiotherapy, there's evidence that it creates dysbiosis. And so dysbiosis is pushing it out of balance, being toxic to that environment. And it does that in a couple of different mechanisms. It's toxic for the gut bacteria, so it can alter it directly, and also because of the immune response that radiotherapy and chemotherapy trigger, that can also indirectly affect the bacterial balance. And interestingly, stem cell transplantation has also been shown to have that effect. There are also side effects that affect the mucosa and the quality of the tissue that lines the wall of the intestines, and that's going to affect what kinds of bacteria develop and the diversity of bacteria there. So, yeah, there's very much a direct effect there. Other kinds of medications that people might be on at the same time too, as well, so things like steroids, for example, may well have an impact, sometimes a positive impact in fact, because they're anti-inflammatory, but sometimes not so positive an impact. There's been a lot of evidence around things like aspirin and ibuprofen, so the non-steroid anti-inflammatories, and how they can be quite preventative of cancer, so because they're anti-inflammatory, which is really great that there's that evidence around there. And I know a lot of people will suggest to people that have had cancer or are at risk of cancer for taking regular small doses of aspirin, for example. My approach is actually to look at other kinds of anti-inflammatories that are going to be a little bit more gentler on other aspects of the body, and also looking at stress pathways to reduce inflammation and gut bacteria and so on. But you know, it's interesting to note that just because something's a medication, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to have a negative effect on a particular area at least. So, but certainly chemotherapy, radiotherapy, yes, it will batter the gut bacteria.
Okay, well, look, there we are. We've got at least three things there which are majorly detrimental to the gut flora. So it's the antibiotics and chemotherapy and radiotherapy. Let's get on now to what do we do about it? I mean, we can assume that those three things are going to cause damage, can't we? I think that's fair to say, isn't it?
Yes.
Given that's the case, we need to do things to prevent that damage or to restore the situation afterwards as quickly as possible. So let's have a look at what those could be.
Okay, well, the first one that I would like to look at is we can't get rid of stress in life. Stress is just there, but looking at our responses to stress, and we can address how our bodies respond to stress in a number of ways. So I've already mentioned that actually working on our bacterial health can affect our response to stress, but there are also lots of other things we can do, like mindfulness practices. I'm a big fan of mindful eating to help there. I call it my bite-sized mindfulness practice that I do at each meal time for at least the first three mouthfuls. I try and make as mindful as possible. But certainly sitting down and having a mindfulness meditation practice can be helpful for a large majority of people, if not everybody. And having a think about what kind of stresses in our lives need to be there or how we can approach them. So if somebody is on radiotherapy or chemotherapy or antibiotics, the stress itself of thinking, oh my goodness, I'm on this medication and it's going to be affecting my gut bacteria.
Right.
The stress of that might actually make it even worse. Mm. So if you've chosen to go down that route, then embrace it and embrace the benefits of what that's going to be doing for you, rather than worrying about the negative impacts. If you're worrying too much about the negative impacts, then that's just going to increase the negative impacts of stress on your body. So whichever decision you make about treatment protocols, embrace it and have that trust that you're going to be getting the maximum benefit from that protocol, whatever you've chosen. And the same with your diet as well. I often have people come to see me who are terrified of eating anything in case it feeds their cancer, and so food becomes the biggest stress for them, whereas actually food needs to be the biggest calming, nourishing anti-stress. So a lot of it is about how you eat. So if you're eating in a fearful way, then that's not going to be helpful. If you're eating by saying, wow, this food, whatever the food is, this food is really nourishing me. I'm really grateful for this food. You know, so even if it's, you know, fast food or a sugary, chocolatey thing or something like that, there will be some nutrients in there somewhere. So if that's what you've chosen to eat in that moment, then rather than stress about lack of willpower or the rubbish in that particular food, focus on the nutrients and the nourishing aspect of that food. And then maybe think about how you can improve choices in the future rather than worrying about that particular meal. Also, if you're eating with stress, then your digestive system will be downgraded and you won't break those foods down particularly well. You won't trigger stomach acid production in your stomach. You won't trigger enzyme production if you're eating with stress or if you're eating mindlessly. If you don't chew your food well as well, if you don't kind of sit up, all those things like chew your food, sit up straight, they're all there to help us, to help food move through the digestive system and to help trigger certain digestive practices that are all going to enable us to break down our foods better, so they're not going to be disrupting the condition of our gut and the condition of our gut microbiome. So it's how we're eating, how we're living our lives will have the first important impact. Mm-hmm. Second to that is what we're eating. So if we're eating lots of really overly processed foods, lots of sugary foods, high levels of carbohydrates, high levels of damaged fats. So things like sunflower oils, olive oils, hemp oils, things like that that have been heated or gone rancid in the light or overly processed. Those kinds of damaged fats as well are going to create a lot of inflammation. So the obvious ones, very high salt diets, the ones that really most of us have an awareness of, high levels of stimulating drinks and foods like alcohol and caffeine and sugars again, to keep those in their place or to avoid them completely, if that's going to be possible, is usually a beneficial thing to do. and instead eating foods that have been cooked from scratch, food that's been made with love, food that has a good variety in there so that you've got some good proteins going in. You've got a good range of vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients going into your diet as well. Again, there's so much in food that we know about that's really nourishing and beneficial. It's not just the energy from food that we need. It's we can't do anything without the minerals, the vitamins, the antioxidants, and all of the other amazing phytonutrients and other things in our foods. So we need all of those. We need a good range of foods to do that. And there's probably more in there that we don't even know about yet. So we don't know everything there is to know about diet and nutrition, just as we don't know everything there is to know yet about the human body. So to a certain extent, we have to trust what our body is telling us, trust our gut feelings around food, what we're being drawn to, get to know whether it's because it feels nourishing or whether it's a craving and something that actually feels like it's... And in fact, we can get a lot of cravings. So a lot of our sugar cravings and carbohydrate cravings can come from bacterial imbalance, craving food for itself. So getting to feel the difference between those and how we can work that. It really involves a change of our approach to eating. So rather than strictly adhering to a fixed diet that somebody's given us or that we've read about or that we've put together, using that as that kind of information as guidelines and really listening to our bodies and letting our bodies feel the way with our diet as well. So in terms of diet, there are general guidelines that I could give, like have smaller amounts of good quality proteins, smaller amounts of good quality whole grain carbohydrates or vegetable carbohydrates, and much higher levels of vegetables, including leafy greens as often as possible. I like to have leafy greens on every plate. And having that kind of diet is usually, for most people, more conducive to a healthy gut and a healthy gut microbiome. But not for everybody. There's always going to be exceptions to that. There are always going to be people that are sensitive to that way of eating for various reasons. So you have to trust your body and listen to that. The third thing that I'd like to address here is hydration. If you're not hydrated, then you can't digest your foods well. Nothing can really function in the body. So that's going to contribute to stagnation, inflammation, all of those conditions that we want to avoid in the body. And the fourth big thing is fermented foods and probiotic supplements. Which are have always been in our diet. So if you look at cultures around the world as far back as we can examine, we've always fermented foods, whether it's yogurts or fermented grains to make fermented porridges. There have always been traditions for fermenting things. I think one of the reasons for that is to make a lot of these foods easier for us to digest, because grains, dairy, we don't digest them particularly easy. Legumes like peas, beans, lentils, things like that. If we can ferment them, then it makes them much easier for us to digest. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be less of an impact on the inflammation and dysbiosis in our gut there. But also, there's something about introducing that biodiversity of bacteria into our gut through our food, through our diet. And one way is through eating fermented foods. So it might be sauerkraut, which is fermented cabbage, sometimes with other vegetables. It might be kimchi, which is a similar thing but spicy. It might be yogurts. It might be kefir, which is a kind of like a watery yogurt, which you can make either with milk or with water or with coconut water. It might be cheese. So some of the blue cheeses, for example, can be particularly beneficial. So a lot of different fermented foods seem to have that really amazing effect on our gut and an important part of our diet. I'd like to just add one thing in here before we move on, Robin, and that's that there's been a huge trend for fermented foods and pickles over the last year or two, to the extent that I've come across people who just eat gallons of the stuff or drink pints of kefir and kombucha and they're eating sauerkraut all day long, and that's actually, I don't think that's beneficial on the whole either, because then you're massively overdoing it, and I've seen a huge spate of people massively overdoing it.
Right.
It used to happen just with taking probiotic supplements, that people would come to see me who had some kind of health condition, especially a lot of people with chronic fatigue, who would come and they would have gone down the route of taking really, really high dose probiotics, and actually it just made things worse. And I'm seeing the same thing now with fermented foods, because they're so on trend at the moment and you can get them everywhere and you can make them, people are more confident to make them. Whereas actually what happens when you suddenly introduce a huge amount of beneficial bacteria into your gut, as I briefly mentioned earlier, it's going to kill off a lot of the detrimental bacteria pretty quickly, which you might think is a good thing, but actually what we're creating there is a battleground in the gut. And with the battleground, you get dead bodies everywhere, releasing their toxic load, right, creating inflammation there and then. So it's not clever to be doing that. It could actually make things a lot worse. So to really be mindful with whether it's fermented foods or whether it's supplements, to build those up mindfully and gradually and really pay attention to how you're actually responding to those.
Okay, message taken. Right, we're just about out of time. I hear you've got a bit of an event coming up which is relevant to what you've been talking about. Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Robin. Yes, on March the 18th, I'm running a day with a lovely, fabulous lady called Hayley North, who is she's a holistic chef, and she's just amazing. She knows so much about food and health and nutrition. Her approach is wonderful. And what we're doing is we've got a day in Ditchling in Sussex, and it's focused particularly on the microbiome and health, mental health, physical health, chronic illness, all aspects of health. So in the morning, we've got a big old catering kitchen, and everyone gets to bring an apron and roll their sleeves up and put together a lunch with Hayley that's specifically focused on foods that and ways of eating that really create a beneficial environment in the gut. And then after lunch, you get to spend the afternoon with me talking about and exploring this whole field and sharing information as well, lots of opportunities to ask questions. So we do this kind of thing fairly regularly on varying different subjects, but it usually comes back to the gut. Our next one's on March the 18th. Our website is bloomholisticretreats.com, and watch that space for further workshops to be announced this year as well.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much indeed, Kirsten. I've learned a fantastic amount today. I hope our listeners have also benefited similarly. And it's been great to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Robin, as well. I always enjoy these chats and blabbing on about nutrition. So thanks once again.
Bye-bye.
Well, we were clearly just scraping the surface of a very big topic there. Details of the event that Kirsten mentioned, where you can find out more, are on the Yes to Life website, along with other resources for the show. Just go to yestolife.org.uk, that's yestolife, yestolife.org.uk, choose Media Centre in the left-hand side bar, and then choose UK Health Radio. If you're new to integrative medicine for cancer, but you want to know more, then do make a point of checking out our book, The Cancer Revolution. It's written by Patricia Pete of Cancer Options, along with 37 other specialist contributors. And you can find out about the book and order online at thecancerrevolution.co.uk. thecancerrevolution.co.uk. Also, a reminder that the videos from our groundbreaking annual conference, Is Cancer a Metabolic Epigenetic Disease?, are also available on the Cancer Revolution website to download at only £7 each. Do keep up with developments at the charity Yes to Life and with me, Robin Daly, on social media during the week. And I'd love you to join me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye.